Good afternoon. Welcome back to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage podiatrist Dr. Ken Swayman. Dr. Swayman's been practicing in Anchorage since 1993. His primary office is on the campus of Alaska Regional Hospital. He works also at Providence Hospital and several of the surgical centers in town. If you want to know how to get in touch with him, we have his office website linked on top of, on our website at kska.org. Today we're going to be trying to tackle your questions about common foot and ankle problems. Some of these might include plantar fasciitis. I particularly want to ask Dr. Swayman about problems of feet and patients with diabetics. And then there's always those persistent, perplexing warts to talk about. So if you want to reach us, if you have any questions or comments, in Anchorage, the number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as always, you can email us during the program at line1, spell it out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1 at kska.org. Kenneth, welcome. It's nice to have you back. Thanks for doing this.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, before we got on the air, we all had an email from a listener who has a couple of questions, so why don't we get started with that. First one is about toenail fungus. We've talked about that a number of times in the past. His specific question is, what are the risks to the oral prescription medications, in particular, what are any severe reactions, and then how costly are these things? So why don't you give us an overview of those problems, and I'm interested, sure. Why do we get more toenail fungus problems than we get fingernail problems?
Well, first of all, the name of the condition is called onychomycosis, which means fungal infection of nail. And basically, it's in the same family as tinea pedis, which is the common athlete's foot fungus or rash, and that can occur between the toes or on the sole or bottom of the foot or even on the top of the foot. And essentially, either one can come first. In other words, you can have a tinea pedis or a fungal infection or athlete's foot between the toes, and it could spread to the nail or vice versa. So in the scenario where you have it on the skin first, why would it spread to the nail? Well, possibly because of some imperfection in the nail. The nail may have a crack. It may have been traumatized for some reason. And the space between the nail plate, which is the hard part of your nail, and the nail bed, which is the skin underneath, has some type of compromise, and the fungal elements have an access way. And once the fungus get between the nail plate and the nail bed, they kind of burrow their way back towards the cuticle area. And underneath that cuticle area is a very vital part of the anatomy of the whole nail complex, and it's called the matrix, or the root of the nail. And once the fungal elements get into the matrix, they're very happy there. It's a very happy place for them. It's a warm, moist, dark environment. And the fungus can thrive. And it's from the nail matrix or root that the plate grows from. So as the new nail grows, the fungal elements are within it. So it's a very hard problem to treat, because if you treat it topically, you're essentially treating an infection that has occurred X number of months ago, because the infection has already been seeded and is basically spreading out further. So the approach topically, if we're lucky, we get about 25% success. And there are various topical medications, be it over-the-counter or prescription strength. And the problem is penetration. In addition to putting the nail topical medicine on, you have to do some kind of physical procedure to the nail to thin it out, such as scraping it with a clean piece of fine sandpaper, a pumice, or an emery board, or something of that sort. There pretty much are no side effects to the topical other than lack of success. The generics are fairly inexpensive. The application is typically daily, and it needs to be done for quite some time, at least 3-4 months. The difference between the topicals and the orals is, you could think of it simplistically, as the orals are kind of hitting the infection from the inside out. You take an oral medication, it spreads through your bloodstream, and it goes to the matrix, and it destroys the fungal elements in the matrix. The biggest risk to the oral medications over the years has been alteration in the enzymes in the liver, thus the liver function. And there have been some serious cases reported, and we're very cautious about that. The monitoring is very straightforward. It's a blood test called a liver function test, and we monitor the enzymes in the liver. If someone has elevated enzymes before starting the medication regimen, they may not be a good candidate for that. If someone has normal enzymes and they go on the medication and the enzymes elevate, that is probably a reason to cease the oral medications. But that's the most common side effect, in the alteration in the liver function enzymes. The pill medications have a success of about 60 to 80%, depending on which study you read and who's done the study. Sometimes you could do what's called polypharmaceutical therapy, where you use topicals and orals, plus physical debridement or scraping of the nail, and that gives you the best possible success.
Cost of these medications?
Well, the topicals are fairly cheap. The generics, you know, on a monthly prorated amount, you know, you're looking at, you know, $10. The prescription strength topicals could be as high as $60 to $75 per month or bimonthly. The orals, when it first came out, as far as the newest generation of the orals, because the oral treatment for fungus has been with us for a long time. The problem is, you know, 20 years ago, the side effect profile exceeded the benefit, so we didn't use it as much. But when terbinafine came out under the trade name Lamisil, the side effect profile was less and the benefit profile was more, so we started using them more. Once terbinafine went generic, the price plummeted. It used to be $1,000 for a 3-month, 90-day mm-hmm. dose, and now it's a fraction of that, and the generic is just as successful as the trade name.
So it sounds like to me that people with nail funguses, particularly the feet, now have a reasonable option at a reasonable cost to have some success.
Oh, yes.
With a small, small risk of some significant side effects.
Correct. And if it's properly monitored, mm-hmm. the complication rate is quite little.
Mm-hmm. And just my question about between feet and hands, nails in the feet probably get more for the reasons that nail funguses are worse in the matrix, because it's damp and moist and injury to the nails is more common, perhaps?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Toenails probably get more of a traumatic beating than fingernails, just from being in shoes. And, you know, the average person takes about 2,200 steps on a mile, so you divide that half each foot. Mm-hmm. If the shoe is fitting improper or... you know, there's been situations of trauma that puts the nail at higher risk, and also just the environment. It's a warm, moist, dark environment, which, you know, fungal elements love.
Let's take one of our calls. Chris, you're on line one. What can we do for you? I think we lost Chris. So let's go ahead and take another question from the email before the program again. Another question he had was, what's the state of the art in metal or other material implants to restore full motion to the big toe joint? I have hallux limitus or rigidus. How durable are these fixes?
Well, hallux limitus, also known as hallux rigidus, is a degenerative joint process of the big toe, where it progressively gets stiff, more difficult to move, and painful to have any type of normal function. One of the treatments for hallux limitus, hallux rigidus, is total joint implant arthroplasty, which is what the question is alluding to, and that's you put some kind of a foreign joint. You basically cut out the diseased joint and put in an implant. Now, implants of the foot is not a new phenomenon. It's been around for years. Different, you know, basically scholastic materials of different flexible natures have been around for decades. And years ago, it was a very popular method of treatment. The problem is the success rate was rather low. The complication rate was rather high. So in the last decade or so, titanium-type implants, or a combination of titanium and ultra-high molecular weight polyurethane, which is basically a supercharged, say, plastic-type material, have been combined to form more durable materials. But the problem is the stresses on the big toe joints, say as compared to a knee implant or a hip implant, are different. And these implants still have some work to do as far as research and long-term durability. But titanium, either alone or titanium with combination ultra-high molecular weight polyurethane, is kind of the state of the art where it's at right now.
Mm-hmm. When you say they still need some work, you don't anticipate the longevity to be as good? They wear out early? There's still discomfort? What do you mean?
All of the above. The indications for total joint implant arthroplasty in the foot is very narrow, and patient selection is key to success. Also, patient expectations is key to satisfaction of the procedure. one of the things I learned years ago, and when I work with students and teach residents over the years, and we talk about implant arthroplasties of the foot, they're basically dynamic spacers. The indication for an implant in the foot is pain. That's the indication. Now, when you're trying to add function to that, it's asking a lot of an implant to perform a function that it's difficult for it to do just because of the nature of the function that's involved in the human gait. So just because an implant in the last 10, 15 years has been introduced and it's expensive, and I'm not saying there are not great ones out there, but the patient selection is the key to success, not necessarily the implant material.
I'm trying to figure out how to summarize this. So basically, you haven't mentioned it's the experience of the surgeon, but experience of the surgeon has a lot to do with making the right choice for the right patient, it sounds like. So
that's a big part of it.
Patient understanding what the optimum and outcomes are. So this is one of these things that you really want to go into with your eyes open and talking to and make sure you have good understanding about expectations and whether or not you're a good
correct
candidate.
The biggest problem with implants, as far as patient expectation and long-term satisfaction, is the joints are very stiff postoperatively. And these implants aren't cheap, and the rehab on it can be a little different than if it was more of a bony reconstructive type procedure. So the risk of unfulfilled expectations is higher when someone has a stiff joint and, you know, they just put an expensive implant in with the expectation that they'd have full range of motion. So the bony architecture surrounding that joint needs to be intact. And again, the expectation as far as what kind of function one will get needs to be within reason for the procedure.
Okay. All right. Chris, looks like he's back on line one. Chris, what can we do for you?
Hi. I have a question about flat feet and hammer toes and running. I come from a family with a number of flat-footed folks, and they've developed very significant hammer toes and discomfort and difficulty finding running shoes that fit. And now I've got a daughter who likes to run, and, of course, she got the flat-foot gene. And I'm wondering about how to prevent her from developing hammer toes.
That's a great question, and I'm exposed to that scenario just about every day. So you kind of said, you know, the gene for flat foot, and you're exactly right about that. When people are born, they're born with certain foot types or foot structures, and it's an inheritance pattern. But people can have a high arch foot, a low arch foot, a flexible foot, or a very stiff and rigid foot. So that you have no control over. Then you factor in the environment, what type of shoes people wear throughout the course of their life, trauma or lack thereof, and what kind of activities they pursue can lead to secondary issues based on the foot type they have. Now, people can get hammer toes that have a flat foot, which we call a pes planus, or a high arch foot, which we call a pes cavus. They can also get hammer toes if they have a very supple or flexible foot, or a rigid or a stiff foot. So what exactly are hammer toes? Hammer toes are changes to the physical structure of the toe, where when you look at the toe and it's on the ground, which we call plantar grade, the toe doesn't purchase or touch the ground evenly across the entire bottom aspect. There's some kind of bend to it, or it could be kind of cocked up. It could be angled to the left or to the right. It could be abutting against the adjacent toes or even going up or over the adjacent toes. And there's many reasons why people get hammer toes, and based on the type of foot type that they inherited and environmental factors that they've experienced, with or without trauma, that could lead to the progression of hammer toes. But a simple way to explain it is you have tendons going to the top and tendons going to the bottom of the toe. And when they're not functioning in dynamic harmony, one is going to pull greater or harder than the other and cause the toe to have an abnormal flexion. Now, if someone has a flat foot and they're in the pediatric age range, and let's say the most common would be a flexible flat foot, and they haven't developed hammer toes yet, and they're very athletic, and they want to be runners or pursue activities that involve impact, such as running, or side-to-side, such as tennis, or racquetball, or court sports like basketball or volleyball, we usually say, look, you need to wear supportive motion control shoes, and you need some kind of insert, what we call an orthotic, to put in the shoe to give the foot some kind of stable framework to function on. That's not a guarantee that as that child becomes an adolescent and a young adult, that contractures of the toes, whether single or multiple, will occur. But it's the best advice, and it's the most conservative approach to take to do something to keep that from going towards that hammer toe situation.
Now, would those need to be like custom-made orthotics?
Not necessarily. Many cases, people don't need custom-made orthotics. Just a good over-the-counter product, like what I recommend pretty much daily to patients, is if there's really no symptoms and we're just going to have this person get used to it. It's a pediatric patient and they're athletic, and we want to get them used to wearing an insert, and we don't know how they're going to do with it, how they're going to tolerate it. Keep it simple, keep it inexpensive, something over the counter like Superfeet. You could buy these at pharmacies here in town, sports stores here in town, you know, running shoe stores here in town. They all have them. You know, there may be some simple differences between the ones they have, but they all range between $30 to $40 in that range. And they're a good first start. If that's ineffective, then there are pre-made orthopedic devices that are still in the inexpensive range. Custom inserts are usually reserved in the pediatric population for when there's symptoms or severe cases of contracture that it would be felt that pre-made devices would be ineffective.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll research that and keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah, but the biggest thing you could do would be, you know, motion control shoes. They're a little stiffer, a little heavier, but they would, you know, give the foot much more stability, and it's a very simple way to possibly control the further progression of the hammer toes.
Right. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
For those that are just joining us, you're listening to Line One. My guest today is Dr. Ken Swayman. We're talking about foot and ankle problems. He's a podiatrist that's been in practice here in Anchorage since 1993. If you've got questions or comment, our number is 550-8433. Our outside number for long distance and toll-free is 1-888-353-5752. And you can reach us during the next hour by email at line1@kska.org. Jim, you're on line one.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks to Dr. Swayman for being on as well. I just wanted to follow up on your earlier discussion on inserts. I've had flat feet all my life, but they're not bothering me. I'm 60 now, but I'm starting to get a bunion where the arch is hitting the bottom of my shoes, and I use regular cheapo inserts, and I have had orthotics, but they don't seem to help as much as the regular inserts. So my question is, you said that you don't go to an insert unless you've got pain, and I was reading there's a product out there called HypoCure. I'm not endorsing it, but it was billed as saying the sooner that you get this, the better off your foot will be for like preventive maintenance. And they've also got these sort of instant gel orthotics you can make at the drugstore now. I'd like you to comment on that, and I'm going to live to be 100 like an uncle of mine. I want to be able to be ambulatory and in good shape like he is.
Well, you'll live to 100 and you'll still have flat feet because orthotics aren't going to change that. In the last few decades, the orthotic industry has kind of skyrocketed, and you can, exactly like you said, go to a store and you know, Dr. Scholl's or whatever company you know, has some kind of a machine you could stand on and make inserts. So it has become an industry and a marketing tool. Now, what I was referring to earlier about, you know, custom inserts versus pre-made orthopedic high-quality inserts versus over-the-counter, and how that applies to symptoms or prevention, probably was too broad of a statement. It's on a case-by-case basis whether I would tell someone, I think you would benefit from a custom insert or you really don't need one. If you have a flexible flat foot and you have had no symptoms, but you see structural changes now occurring, and you say to yourself, I would like to prevent these structural changes from progressing either to the to the point where they're progressing that it causes pain, or progressing to the point where it's difficulty finding shoes, then certainly getting an insert that possibly is custom made to and tailored to your needs may be appropriate. If it's not that much of a concern to you, you know, once again, you could start off with just something on a more rigid nature. You see, when you're starting to have structural changes occur, that means the foot is adapting abnormally, and the actual bone structure and joint structures are changing. So a soft cushion device or gel device may feel good because it's giving you extra padding or cushioning on the bottom, or we call the plantar surface of the foot, but it's not changing foot function. And if you're actually noticing a bunion, a lot of people, and I'm not alluding to the fact that you may not have a bunion, but a lot of people come in and they say, you know, they have a bunion, and it's actually something else.
It's just something that's building a callus where the arch would normally be at its highest. It's where the foot is in the shoe.
See, like a bunion is an actual structural change to the base of the big toe joint. When it's more in the arch, it could be a different situation that's going on. But again, pressure reduction inserts, motion control shoes, which tend to be a little stiffer, a little more rigid, would be, you know, my first advice. But again, if there's actual structural changes, that may need more of a more formal evaluation to get a little more appropriate recommendations.
Thanks for taking my question.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you for calling. Max, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call, and I enjoy the show tremendously. 20 years ago, I broke my right ankle very seriously. Foot was upside down on my leg, and my toes were pointed backwards. The first four doctors I saw wanted to freeze or make a permanent location of my ankle, and I wanted it to still be flexible. So Dr. Brudenell here in town did a great job, and I can bend my ankle and flex it and pretty much walk normally now. So thanks very much, Dr. B. Over the years, though, I have worn the cartilage, the shock absorber tissue in the ankle joint out, and I'm told that this is common as a result of a major injury like this, that and what it's giving me now is pain in the ankle as if I had arthritis. I've seen a few commercials lately that talk about someone here in town that's growing cartilage. Primarily, they talk about it for the knee. I don't want to have an ankle replacement, and I understand they're not quite as ready to do them as they are knee replacements or hips. And I'm wondering if you have any suggestions about this cartilage growth.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you have a classic case of traumatic arthritis. So you do, in fact, have arthritis. 20 years ago, you had what's called a fracture dislocation of your ankle. It was reduced and put back in place, and you probably had hardware put in. It may or may not still be in. And the surface of your ankle, as best as Dr. Brudenell could have done, you know, was not the same afterwards. And it took 2 decades to progress to the point where the cartilage is thinning out, or there may be certain areas where the cartilage is in fact worn out, and you'd be able to tell that quite clearly these days with an MRI.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I did have an X-ray 3 or 4 years ago, and you could clearly see a natural space in my left ankle and hardly any space in my right ankle.
Yeah, bone on bone on a plain radiograph is pretty indicative of advanced arthritis. So what's happening, whether you're aware of it or not, is your body is starting to fuse your ankle for you. You're in the process of an auto ankle fusion, like it or not. The body doesn't want to move a joint that's arthritic and painful, so it'll start building extra bone around the joint. We call them osteophytes, or bone spurs is the common term. And the joint will become progressively stiffer, harder to move, and more bulbous in appearance. Now, the treatments, you know, the non-surgical treatments to nurse it along are ankle braces. We use what's called an AFO, ankle-foot orthotic, that basically goes on the bottom and back of the leg to limit the motion. And periodic medications, either oral anti-inflammatories or intra-articular injections of cortisone, where you actually put an anti-inflammatory in the joint. These are symptom-relieving modalities only. When you talk about surgical options, you know, you can clean up any loose fragments that's floating around. You can, you know, the cartilage transplantation, it's a hot topic. It is used in the knee quite readily. It's an expensive operation with results that are variable on a patient-by-patient basis. And depending on the extent of degeneration, you can give a predictable outcome. You know, if the lesion is greater than, say, the size of a quarter versus smaller, you know, how much cartilage has to be grown. If the joint is totally gone and there's essentially minimal effective articular cartilage, unfortunately, the best surgical options that's withstood the test of time and that's considered a standard of care community by community by community is either joint arthrodesis or fusion or total implant arthroplasty. And they are both big procedures, but they have more of a predictable outcome.
The total implant is replacing the ankle joint like you'd replace a knee or hip joint.
Correct. And there's different approaches for that. You could use cadaveric tissue. Basically, you're using donor human tissue that has cartilage and bone, and you're putting that in as your graft. Or you're using some kind of foreign material, be it titanium, surgical stainless with the cadmium, nickel, molybdenum, and polyurethane type products.
Okay, I note that part of the show, Dr. Woodard has everybody bring their crystal ball in. So if you look to the left at your crystal ball.
Well, I left the crystal ball at the office because I was in a rush to get here.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe you could call somebody.
Yeah.
What's going to be my best indication for me to know when I need to make that step? In other words, I can walk pretty normally now. I can't stride forward very far because of the limited mobility of my right foot, and I'm not really able to run. And it limits my exercise, and it limits my activity. So that's about where I'm at now. And I did have hardware put in it, but it's all out of there now because it interfered with how my shoe fit. I have good strength in my ankle, but it's not as strong as my left foot because I'm depending more on my left foot.
Right.
What should be my indication as to, okay, Max, it's time for you to go pursue one of these options?
Well, first of all, you've probably been compensating, whether you're aware of it or not, over the years, basically babying that ankle and lower leg and putting stresses further out towards the foot or even the contralateral, what we call the other leg. When any activity, even just walking and doing your activity of daily living, your basic necessity skills, becomes painful. Every step, swollen, very difficult to get from point A to point B. That's pretty much when you've reached your end stage. If it's a matter of activity changes and modifications to get you by, well, certainly that's an option and a viable one at that. And there are other methods that, are more conservative that, are pain-relieving modalities. Keep it at that. They're not going to cure you. And that's, anti-inflammatories and, corticosteroid injections and physical therapy to strengthen, the muscles and tendons around the joint to give you more stability. But depending on, your future endeavors, desires, possibly more injury, that unexpected.
Okay.
You'll know. Usually people know when it's time.
Yeah. I have had two injections in the last 5 or 6 years, but it wasn't cortisone. It was the material from the top of the rooster's crown. What is, I forget, was Synvisc?
Well, Synvisc really was indicated for the knee, a series of three injections. Kind of think of it as like slick 50. You're putting it in your engine to give a little grease. And it works, sometimes. It's a little tougher in the ankle just because of the stresses that occur in the ankle. But again, it can buy time, and it could give you some relief.
It gave me a lot of relief for 8 or 9, maybe even 9 months to a year, but the insurance company wouldn't recognize it as therapy for the ankle, so I had to pay for it myself. That I wasn't happy about that, but they're in charge of that issue.
Right.
And I do have a good orthopedic surgeon here in town that I see. It's just these tissue growth commercials I've seen lately. I thought, well, maybe there's some way I could, grow some of that tissue back. But it sounds like no.
Well, no. I think you can. But, again, it's all a matter of expectations, and it's how much disease do you have in the joint? If it's a small area, a lesion that's, you know, a centimeter, 2 centimeters, there are procedures where you could even transfer cartilage from non-articular parts of the knee. You actually take a plug out of the knee and you transfer it to the ankle. And you don't even have to, there's no time wasting. You don't have to grow the cartilage. You're just transferring your own cartilage from point A to point B. But again, that has to deal with the size of the lesion.
Okay.
And the location. Okay. The limitation is if the amount of degeneration is so enormous that it may not be as effective.
I would have to say the degeneration of my ankle is pretty significant. Listen, thanks very much for taking the call and good info.
Good luck.
Good luck, Max.
All right, man. Bye-bye.
All right. We've already eaten up half of our time, so I'm going to have to take a short break. Let me remind our listeners you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. In Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8433, toll free 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@kska.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue to take calls and emails and talk with Anchorage podiatrist Dr. Ken Swayman on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage podiatrist Dr. Ken Swayman, and we're addressing your questions and comments about disorders of the foot and ankle. If you've got questions, you can email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. You can call us directly over the next 30 minutes or so at 550-8433. It's 550-8433, and our outside, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening tonight or at night at 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock, you're listening to a recorded rebroadcast and won't be able to take your calls. What about barefoot running and that craze? What's all that about? Is it worthwhile talking about even if you live in Alaska? But what if you don't live in Alaska?
Well, it's an interesting craze, and it works for some people, and again, on a case-by-case basis. When people ask me that on a weekly basis, I evaluate their foot type, their foot structure, and their Achilles tendon, and to some people, it's fine, and to other people, it could be a devastating thing to try to run barefoot due to the forces on the foot. So to say that everyone should run barefoot, regardless of the climate, I would think is an incorrect statement, but for some people that have foot function that can accommodate that and have no structural concerns, I think it's fine.
We've got a couple of callers and one email, and I want to get to those. There's a number of other issues, and I also, though, have promised a couple of people to address some shoe issues. And there's two major shoe issues that I want to ask about. Currently, there's also another craze, and that's using these rocker-like shoes. I think they're called MBTs and Skechers. And then I've also had someone comment that apparently a lot of the teenage girls now at dances are wearing very high, almost stiletto-like heels. And despite the fact that they're wearing them and going to the dance, they seem to be hurting a lot during the dance. You want to comment on these rocker-like shoes and high heel shoes?
Well, the concept of a rocker sole shoe actually comes from the orthopedic shoe community. When someone has degenerative disease or a fused big toe joint or something like that, we actually prescribe rocker shoes. So it's actually a welcomed craze because it takes the pressure off the ball of the foot. So if there's any kind of ailments in the forefoot, a little bit of a rock or sole can be beneficial. On the negative side, though, it gives instability to the heel because the heel will tend to rock backwards. And if there's any kind of Achilles issues or posterior hindfoot issues, they can be exacerbated. So again, on a case-by-case basis, it should be evaluated whether it's a proper style with benefit. As a global statement to say that everyone should be doing it would be incorrect. As far as high heels, you know, the concept of bringing the heel closer to the knee takes the Achilles tendon and contracts it. So prolonged use of high heels, I see a lot of dancers, and ballroom dancers especially, dance with high heels, and they'll have a lot of Achilles problems when then they decide to go to the gym and run, because it's the change in the length of the Achilles tendon from their activity dancing ballroom style in a high heel to running flat on a treadmill. So issues of the Achilles tendon are the biggest problems I see with athletic women that wear, say 2 to 3+ inch heel, and then also participate in high level athletics.
I have an email. A 13-year-old son was recently diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. He has both of his second toes are quite long and have a tendency to be curled down. He reports no negative symptoms at all. What specific concerns should we watch for, and what steps should we take to prevent any problems? So this is addressing the general hygiene for diabetics.
Well, we could talk beyond an hour on diabetic foot and all of the complications that can occur with that. This particular case sounds like the teenager has what's called a Morton's toe. It's a long second toe. The phalange bones of the toe and maybe the second metatarsal that corresponds to the second toe is possibly a little long. So the longest toe is going to be the second, which means it could hit the end of the shoe. It could buckle into a hammer toe, which we talked about earlier. The big concerns with diabetes is later advancement of angiopathy or lack of blood flow to the lower extremity and neuropathy when there's four different types of neuropathy. The best advice, for a young diabetic is to teach the appropriateness and necessity of glucose homeostasis, good glucose control. All the problems we typically see in diabetics are people that have had, whether type 1 or type 2 diabetes, greater than 10 years with poor glucose control. And with the long second toe, you have to make sure that the shoes are measured from the tip of the long second toe, and it's a half a thumb's width from the end of that toe. Classically, people are always measured by the big toe. The classic device is called the Brannock device, and that's still fine. It's withstood the test of time. But I think the thumb test, and of course you can't do it on every shoe because some shoes aren't supple enough where you could push them down and actually feel the end of the toe. But purchasing shoes at the end of the day, when the foot is its largest or most swollen, wearing the appropriate sock that you would be for that particular the activity that you'd be doing in that shoe, and daily inspection of the feet, and again, glucose control to avoid the future complications of angiopathy and neuropathy.
Okay. Another question is about foot cramps. What causes these things to happen? Is there something being done to prevent them, and how do you stop it once they start?
Well, foot cramps or spasms could be from a whole host or variety of etiologies or pathologies, most common being a particular muscle or a tendon is being stressed beyond its capacity, and it spasms as a defensive mechanism, possibly lack of blood flow or overuse, blunt trauma, ice skating when your feet are real cold and you're turning up the gas and skating real fast and you get flexion contractures of the toes in your skate. So contracture of a muscle tendon complex or a spasm is usually not an isolated event. There's a history that led up to that. So proper diagnosis to figure out what is happening, what are the most likely reasons why it's happening, and then alter the course of events so that it happens less frequently.
What do you do once they start?
Well, you want to cease the activity that you're participating in that's causing it. So, for instance, let's just say you're ice skating and your toe spasms down. You know, stop skating, take your skates off, and then there are certain stretching techniques. Now, every muscle, you know, has a certain function. And, you know, if you're not familiar with that function, you wouldn't know the exact most appropriate stretch to do, you know, to basically counteract the spasm that's happening. But, you know, basic common sense, if the foot is flexing downward, you try to relax it and just kind of stretch it out upward and vice versa. But there's nuances to that, and you know, you certainly don't want to cause more harm by stretching ineffective, where you actually start to pull tissue and injure it further.
Okay. Let's take a phone call. Eric, you're on line one.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. Well, 35 years old, and I've had multiple ankle sprains basically through athletics since I was about 15. And now most recently I sprained my right ankle playing volleyball back in about October. And it hasn't recovered like they have usually. It's still painful just when idle, just sitting. I've noticed it clicks quite a bit. And it's just kind of generally painful, and I'm going to go to the doctor, but I'm wondering what I can expect.
Well, the condition you're describing is called chronic ankle instability. Now, when someone has a sprain, by definition, is an injury to a ligament or ligaments, and any joint in our body can suffer a sprain. The common ankle sprain is described as laterally, so it's on the little toe side of the ankle. It's actually the most common sports-related injury we see. So the lateral ankle sprain, very common injury. There are three tiny little ligaments that come off the bottom of the fibula or one of the leg bones. Ligaments are like tiny little rubber bands. They're not big, and yet they have a huge function. They keep two bones at a joint from dislocating or becoming unstable. When a ligament is pulled or torn, we call that a sprain. There are degrees of sprains, and depending on the classification system the physician or clinician chooses to use. But the simple classification is you have a mild, moderate, or severe sprain. Mild would be the rubber band or the ligament tissue pulls, but nothing actually tears. Moderate would be the ligament pulls. Some of the fibers tear, but some remain intact. And a severe sprain would be a complete disruption, and that can occur in the mid-body or the central aspect of the ligament, or actually where it attaches the bone and pulls off. People that I see that are several years to several decades of complaining of instability, where they don't feel confident, they don't feel stable. When they're doing side-to-side activity, their ankle rolls. Walking on uneven terrain, hiking on trails, rocky trails, skiing, etc. It usually goes back to a history of a sprain of a moderate to severe degree that may have been, I'm not going to say inappropriately treated, because it may have been treated appropriately, but just didn't heal proper. But a lot of times they just kind of get dismissed as, you know, put an ACE wrap on it and, you know, 20 years ago you did that. And then now you know is that any little activity you do that has some stress, you feel very unstable and your confidence is low. And the reason is when the ligament was disrupted, the ligament heals by scarring. So if you think of a rubber band and you keep pulling that rubber band apart, eventually you get a condition called attenuation. It means if the rubber band is a certain distance from point A to point B and a certain thickness, you can extrapolate that as a certain strength. If now all of a sudden point A to point B is twice the distance, the thickness of the ligament is half the size, which means the strength of the ligament will be 50% decreased. So if as it healed ineffectively or with a lot of scar tissue and a lot of attenuation, that's what leads to instability. And then with the lateral ankle, there's three ligaments. You could say you have a 1, 2, 3 or all, you know, ligament involvement. And, you know, the clicking could be that there is a loose fragment, an ossicle of bone and or cartilage that chipped off from the original event or subsequent events that happened and has been floating in the joint, which is essentially like a tide pool. It's this fluid inside your joint. And around the joint is an envelope called a capsule that keeps the fluid in place. And if there's a loose fragment, bone and or cartilage floating around, depending on where that is at any one time during any activity, it could click and pop and snap and could be quite painful. So a full, thorough workup, physical examination, x-rays, possibly MRI, can really hone in on that. And nowadays, we have very nice techniques to alleviate the chronic pain associated with old ankle sprains and even deal with the instability that is subsequent to it.
Okay. Yeah, of all the sprains I've had, this one I actually took the treatment for granted because I've had so many. I figured I could just self-diagnose, and I never actually went to the doctor. And this is the one that I'm certain you're right. I'm certain that there's a bone fragment in there because I've never had this clicking before. So
yeah, it's possible.
I guess that answers my question. I guess I know what to expect. So if that's the case, and I think it is, what can I expect as far as treatment for that bone fragment?
Well, not every bone fragment in a joint has to be removed. You know, sometimes people live with it just fine. If it's a simple open it up and, you know, pluck it out, it can be done arthroscopically or open. And at the same time, the ligaments can be stabilized if it's deemed appropriate. And a simple plication, going back to that rubber band analogy, if the rubber band's too long, too thin, you cut it in half and you overlap it by 50%, and now you're back to where you were square one. And that's kind of the simple explanation of what an ankle stabilization procedure is. It's reefing up your ligaments to get them back to how they were anatomically before the event happened.
Good. Okay. Well, thank you very much. That answers all my questions. I sure appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Let's see, we have a caller from Kenai now. Anne, you're on line one.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. And I wondered, on occasion, I get a repeatable pain on my heels, like on the side of my heel. It's very painful and deep. And I just wondered what that might be. It feels like a strong, burning, pulling sensation.
Well, heel pain could be a lot of different entities. Is it on the bottom, or you mentioned on the side?
Yeah, it's more on the side. Sometimes it'll just go all the way to the bottom, but it seems to start at the side.
Is it the side by your big toe or your little toe or the back?
Sometimes it's both. It's on the inside, you know, on the side where the big toe is, and also on the back, more towards, it's on the right side where the little toe would be, but more towards the very back part of the foot.
Well, you know, the most common situation for heel pain is a condition called fasciitis. There's a big, thick ligament or a rubber band that's on the bottom of the heel, and it happens to be thickest on the bottom inside of the heel. And when that ligament is getting pulled, it's not, by definition, it's not truly a ligament, but we explain it that way just for simplicity. It's actually a deep organized layer of fat. If that fascia gets pulled, it could be a tremendous source of pain. But there's also nerves that are on the bottom of the heel. There's also a bursa, a sac of fluid that resides on the bottom of the heel. So it's kind of hard to diagnose that one over the radio without an exam and more detailed questions. The other concern is there something going on with the calcaneus or the heel bone? And the only way to really know that is to get a radiograph or an x-ray. Sometimes heel pain could be a cyst or, you know, and less common, but it does happen, you know, a tumor in the heel. So proper workup is essential to give you the correct answer on that one.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
A couple of more emails. Let's see if we can get through these before we're done. We're running out of time. This is a 70-year-old lady who has a hammer toe, or toes are more curled up and continuing to be getting worse with time. She's now 70. There's some numbness. Do you think she might require surgery?
Well, you know, the numbness could be that the nerves are getting contracted. You know, just because the hammer toes are developing and some numbness is occurring doesn't mean surgery tomorrow. You know, certainly shoe changes can be implemented, possibly physical therapy, pharmaceutical agents such as injections or short course of oral medications, all can be tried before surgery. So surgery is not mandatory just because the hammer toe is progressing and some numbness is occurring.
Sounds like it might be worth just getting an opinion and have someone look at it and
Absolutely.
See what's best.
Yes.
All right, so here's an email about our favorite, plantar warts. Could you please explain the problem or address the problem of plantar warts and how to cure them?
Well, plantar warts have been around a long time, and they'll be around a long time. And if you do research on warts, you'll find a plethora of treatments, and that's because no one treatment works for everybody. Essentially, it's a virus infection that affects the epidermis, so the outermost layer of skin. The epidermis is the thinnest layer of the skin in the whole body, with the exception being on the plantar or bottom of the foot, especially the ball and the heel. So if someone gets an imperfection in the epidermis, a callus, a fissure, a crack, the skin is too moist, too dry, exposure to the virus, whether from themselves, their environment, or other people, the virus then sets up in the epidermis, and it kind of manifests like looks like a callus. The big difference is that it steals blood supply from the next layer of skin, which is called the papillary dermis, and basically shunts blood to feed itself. Warts are exophytic, meaning they grow out. So from the skin level, they would grow out. But on the bottom of the foot, since we walk, they get pushed back in. So you get this iceberg phenomenon where the top surface of the wart on the bottom of the foot has a certain diameter. But in actuality, it's bigger because it's getting pushed back in due to weight bearing. Hit the second layer, called the dermis, where the wart typically doesn't live. And then it spreads peripherally. Many, many treatments, classic treatments, you know, spraying nitrogen or, using various chemicals. I like to use pretty benign treatments that work in a large majority of people, that's easy to self-administer, that has a high success rate. If that fails, then there's always the possibility of, you know, physically cutting them out. The risk of cutting them out is that there's a 10% recurrence rate, there's potential for scarring, and secondary bacterial infection. So it's not my first choice when I'm presented with an isolated or multiple warts on the bottom of the foot to cut them out as a primary procedure, but rather a secondary or tertiary procedure when the less invasive, more conservative therapies fail.
Do you have a favorite self-remedy or self-treatment?
Well, you know, over-the-counter, they do sell sal acid in cream and in plasters, and, you know, FDA only allows a certain percentage. The higher the percentage, the more effective. But, as you probably know, Dr. Woodard, there was a pediatric study done probably about 20 years ago now where they just put duct tape on warts, and the theory is, you know, smothering the wart, and there is something in the glue of the duct tape that elicits an immune response, and the wart basically gets spit out. The interesting part of that study was that it was more effective just putting duct tape on 24/7 for 6 days in a row, on the seventh day taking the duct tape off and scraping the heck out of it and then reapplying it week after week after week. It's not a quick therapy by any means. But they had a higher success rate than using the traditional nitrogen, be it sprayed or painted on, with far less complications and much more patient compliance and pleasure because there wasn't any pain. I like the sal acid creams as a primary treatment, and if they fail, we try the topicals before cutting them out.
I usually, you know, tell me whether you agree with this, I usually recommend soaking and then paring it down with a pumice board or an emery board, regardless of how you're treating it. If you're using the duct tape, then you do it every 6 days. If you're using one of the sal acid, right, almost nightly. Do you think that helps? And
then
there's also... people need to understand that most of these warts have a half-life of about 2 years, is my understanding, so that there's a good chance they may go away with it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I would say close to 50% of warts, you know, an isolated wart, and again, this is patient-specific and, you know, you have to delve into the history, but most warts will spontaneously go away in 6 months to a year. They get pissed off enough, you scrape at them, you pluck at them, they're gonna leave. But, you know, there's a large majority that don't. And then when they start to spread, it can be quite concerning, especially on a kid with the parents, and everyone in the house is worried about catching them. Softening them in some kind of soak, and then, you know, what you're describing is the briding the wart. You're removing some of the tissue. So, and that's basically what the chemicals do. They're like a chemical peel. You're putting the medicine on, and you're eating away through the epidermis, layer by layer or cell by cell, if you would. And then once you get down to the dermis, the next layer of skin, in theory, the wart will not be living in that layer, and the wart is gone. You just look like you have a little burn wound there.
We have about 3 minutes. Let's see if we can get one or two more questions answered. This is an email. I'm wondering if you could comment on Vibram five-finger shoes. Are they useful in strengthening the foot? I have flat feet. often with sore arches, and also bunionectomies on both feet. Would these shoes be okay to try, or is it still up in the air? Question mark.
Well, it's up in the air. There's no formal medical studies that have been done on any of these shoes over the last, say, 5 years. I think a general comment would be if it feels good and it makes you function fine, well, by all means, wear it. It's not going to reverse any structural entity that has already occurred.
Another email. I have a teenager, 16. He has large toes that are curving out like a bunion is forming, but he doesn't really seem to like a bunion. We've purchased wider toe box shoes for him, but are concerned about the long-term foot changes. He's very flat-footed. So this is one where the more I read it, I'm not sure you got enough information. What, you think you can handle that or not?
Well, you know, again, it goes back to an earlier comment about a flat foot on a kid and, you know, will that kid develop hammer toes? Flexible flat feet do develop bunions and hammer toes. The question is, will they be symptomatic, bunions or hammer toes? What can you do to prevent them? Again, it goes back to the basics, supportive motion control shoes, stiff soles, you know, possibly some type of insert therapy. That situation may need more formal evaluation to give a proper answer.
All right, and the last one with just a couple of minutes is the classic plantar fasciitis question. In a email, do we really know the cause and theory behind why it occurs? How effective are newer, expensive, super-focused ultrasonic therapies for plantar fasciitis?
What do we have 3 minutes or about 3 days?
about 2.5 minutes.
Plantar fasciitis, where do I start with that one? Plantar fasciitis is an irritation to this deep fascia or fat on the bottom of the foot that runs from the heel to the ball of the foot, and it's due to faulty mechanics or blunt trauma. Mechanical control is the gold standard, shoes and inserts, stretching of the plantar structures, stretching of the calf muscle. The surgical techniques, in my opinion, are a last resort. The sound wave therapies, or we call it orthotripsy, is something I did do years ago, did a bunch of them. I was not pleased with the success rate. The cost was prohibitive. The outcomes were not exceptional by any means. So it's not something that I use as a primary therapy. I would have to refer that person to our website, alaskapodiatry.com. It's all on there. They could look up plantar fasciitis and then some. Impossible to answer that one in 3 minutes.
All right. There's a little question here about Morton's neuroma. I had one removed, and the sharp pain is gone. There's still a lump there that makes walking uncomfortable. I was told it was scar tissue.
Well, anytime you cut a nerve, there's going to be some component of regrowth. 10% of neurectomies will have some kind of, we call a stump, and it could be a stump neuroma, which can be as bad, if not worse, than the original problem. When you remove a neuroma from any part of the body, especially the foot between the metatarsals, which is by the toe area, you create a void, and that can fill in with scar tissue, and it could be like a lump.
All right. Thanks very much, Ken. My guest today was podiatrist Dr. Ken Swayman. Yeah, we're out of time. We have one caller we just didn't get to. I apologize. Line One will return next week, and we're going to talk with Dr. S.J. Olshansky. He's a national authority on aging and longevity. So why don't you join us Monday, January 17th at 2 p.m. for the next edition of Line One, Your Health Connection. Pat Yeck is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered the program today and manned the phones. Thanks for listening, especially those who took the time to call or email. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.